kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. We have another reviews episode lined up to you. A lot of big games to get to, a lot of stuff to talk about. As you could hear from the wheezing, we are being joined, first off, Jacob Garner. You're here. How are you doing?
My entire house has a stomach flu right now.
Sweet. You sound fantastic.
I feel fantastic. Although I do feel better than I did earlier, so.
Well, that's a positive.
You know. Yeah. So, you know. I'm not going to go into the details for our viewers unless, like, I have to, like, bolt out the room really quick.
Viewers, that's hilarious.
Sorry, listeners, my bad.
Listeners, that's hilarious.
Well, you know, somebody might be watching on Twitch, right?
I'm not streaming this.
Oh.
This is a review episode. This is the one where I just record a bunch of shit and staple it together and pretend it's a full episode.
You don't even, like, stream those?
No. Oh.
I thought you would just stream while you're at your PC, you know, just so you're doing something.
No, because streaming for a 15-minute segment just doesn't really have any kind of significance to it.
Like, any of this has any significance to it?
Touche. I like where you're thinking. Yeah, this is all stapled together.
Let's get this going.
All right. First game to talk about on this episode is called Ace Combat 7 Skies Unknown, developed by Project Aces, published by Bandai Namco, released January 18th on Xbox One, PS4, and PC for $59.99. Become an ace pilot and soar through the
prehistoric?
Man, photorealistic. Oh my god.
What a direction I wasn't expecting. You know, you fight dinosaurs and shit.
My brain did not read that properly. I knew it was wrong the second it came out. But
they really got interested in the Far Cry Primal, and they were like, yes, this is the direction we need to take Ace Combat.
Shooting down pterodactyls and shit. Let me try that again. Become an ace pilot and soar through the photorealistic skies with full 360-degree movement, down enemy aircraft, and experience the thrill of engaging in realistic sorties. Aerial combat has never looked or felt better. Jacob, tell us about it without the dinosaurs.
Oh, man. Like, it's been years since I played an Ace Combat game. Like, it has to be the Xbox 360, so that means, oh god, when was the last game that came out? It had to be, like, almost a decade ago, right?
Close to that, yeah. It's been a while.
Like, I mean, I think they made, like a spin-off thing, like, a couple of years ago, I think. But, you know, like, an actual numbered entry. It's been a while. So, yeah. First off, holy crap, this game is beautiful. It's just gorgeous to look at and play through and, like, when they say it looks photorealistic, yeah, like, everything does. The terrain looks amazing. The planes look amazing. When you blow your enemies out of the sky, like, it's, like, one of the coolest things is just, like, flying through the debris from, like, a shot that was just, like, a couple seconds, like, you know, too close from you being killed by crashing into an enemy plane. Like, honestly, it's absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, so there's that.
Yeah, I've heard through other people who've played the game that the game is just stunning to look at.
Yeah, like, I can't imagine what it looks like on your TV. Like, like, so eventually I'm just gonna have to come over to your house and play. Like, and this thing's got to be a beast in, like, VR, because I've heard that there is a VR version of it.
Yeah, on the PlayStation 4, they have VR capability.
Oh, man, that's got to be insane. Like, I can't imagine how that looks. Like, it's, I
can't imagine how sick it would make me.
True, but at the same time,
way to
take me on your body wings tonight.
Namco is gonna love this review.
God. So there is a storyline to the game. It's these two warring factions. It's almost like warring continents or maybe organizations like NATO versus, what did the Russians have during the Cold War? I forget. It was just a Warsaw Pact, wasn't it? Whatever. Anyway.
I'm uncultured and stupid.
Well, yeah, but we love you anyway.
You liar.
It's true. So, like, there is a story, but it's just, like, it's almost, like, non-existent, I don't want to say it's non-existent, but, like, it tries to go into, like, some Tom Clancy-level shit, but it just falls by the wayside, and I thought what was kind of interesting is, like, as they're doing it, because they give you, like, they're telling you, like, what you need to be doing for the mission, and, like, they're also giving you some background as to, like, why you need to be doing certain things. And there's also chatter during the briefings that come into play. But at the same time, it's just, like, it feels like it's something that you just want to, like, skip through and just, like, yeah, I want to blow this shit out of the sky. you know? So, you know, if you're looking for, like, an amazing story, I don't know if it's really going to be found here.
How is the meat of the action? How is the fighting, the shooting, the pew-pewing? How's all that stuff?
For the most part, it's pretty great. I was having a lot of fun just shooting, you know, enemies out of the sky. And the missions are varied. Like, you know, initially you start off with, like, I'm just, like, shooting up enemies. There are stealth missions, and there are a couple of escort missions, which I was like, this is bogus, because I just want to blow things out of the sky. You know, but I do like that they did vary it up for what presumably actual, you know, Air Force pilots would have to do. You know, and as I said, like, the game doesn't actually give you a tutorial level, so you're kind of there figuring it out on your own, and the game does give, like, helpful, like, heads-up stuff every once in a while. And during the chatter, like, your co-pilots will remind you, oh, you need to be doing this, use your flares, all this other kind of stuff. So, like, you will figure it out as you go along. You are going to die. You are going to crash. Like, there's plenty of times I thought I was going to, you know, I was going to be able to cut a turn quick enough. And then I ended up crashing into the ground and stuff like that.
Proud of you.
The first time I actually crashed, I was on the runway. So, believe it or not, I was trying to figure out the controls real quick, and I ended up, you know, pointing the plane down instead of up. So my very first, you know, yep. You know what? I hope you crash too.
Oh, man. Do you at least get an achievement for something like that?
No.
Oh, man.
This game is stingy on its achievements too.
That could have trolled you so bad.
Like for finishing each mission, you get 5 points, and it's just like, oh.
That must be some big ones later on then.
Well, it's crazy because the thing is that, like, you can, going back to gameplay and stuff, because I will talk about that one achievement, you can go back and play your missions, and you can, like, replay them however you want. Like, you can play them without the mission objectives and just blow, and, like, just start, like, you know, just blowing everything up. And, you know, you can fly around the area and figure out where the enemies actually come out of and stuff like that. So then, like, when you do a real, you know, run through, you're more prepared. You can also play it with different plane settings and like what the game would normally allow you to. So you can do all that kind of stuff, but the game doesn't let you earn credits while you're doing it, you know? So it's just like, it almost feels like the free play mode is like if you really want to understand the mechanics of a level, then I guess that's okay. But otherwise it almost feels like there's no point to it.
Yeah.
Which then like later on, so like you're going to have to do a lot of replay, especially when you get up to like the higher difficulty levels. And for beating all of the missions on the hardest difficulty is like 60 points period.
Damn.
Which I was just like, yeah, like I was really surprised by that. The game has multiplayer to it. I didn't get to play that much with it. Like there's team battles, there's one-on-one, there's a free for all that kind of stuff. The team stuff seemed pretty neat. But there was like a confusing bounty system on it. So like the players who are really performing well, it actually awards you more points for killing them. So, you know, it can really mess with like the score. Like, so you could have like shot down like 50 guys, presumably. But like, you know, if the other team like managed to score like, you know, the top three bounties, then, you know, they could easily boost past you and score. So, so there was that. I know that there is DLC planned for it.
Obviously.
Yeah, there is a season pass that's available for $30. So I'm kind of curious as to what's going to churn out with that. The only thing that the description says is that there's going to be a music player. So I don't know if that means that you can add in the Top Gun soundtrack while you're playing.
I'm going to guess it'll let you play the music that's in the game.
Maybe. I don't know. But
although adding the Top Gun soundtrack would be pretty fantastic.
It would. Except to, like when you get to like Berlin's Take My Breath Away, you know, as like you're in a really tense mission. It was like, oh, Mayday, Mayday, everyone's dying. Take my breath away.
And we got a copyright strike.
I don't sound that good.
By the way, I think I found the big achievements that are eating up most of the points. There's one, completed all missions in campaign mode on all difficulties. That one's 60. I think that's the one you're talking about.
Yeah, that's what I mentioned.
Complete all campaign mode missions on Ace difficulty with an S rank. That's 80. And then obtain all medals in campaign mode, and that's 100.
Not ever going to get those.
So if you are looking into this for easy achievements, think again.
Yeah. But yeah. So yeah, I think that's pretty much, I think I covered all bases, right?
Yeah, for the most part.
It
looks well. It looks really well. It plays well. Could use a tutorial, and it's going to kick your ass.
Yeah. And also, like, I kind of wish that there was more variety with the planes, but, you know, I figure that's what the DLC is about.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's coming. But I was really happy with the product that, you know, that shipped. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So. Well,
then overall, $60 on this one. What is your verdict?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, there are very few games that like I've been like this, you know, gung-ho about on this show, but this is like an absolute buy. I highly recommend it. It was a lot, like, it's a lot of fun. I'm definitely gonna keep playing this, and I look forward to seeing what else comes out, and hopefully it's not, you know, another like 10 years before we get the next Ace Combat.
Yeah, hope so. Something to keep in mind from what I am hearing and seeing online, the game is not enhanced for the Xbox One X or the PS4 Pro. So it basically just runs as it was optimized for the standard PS4. Hopefully the game does well enough that they look into optimizing it better for the more powerful systems.
Yeah.
But otherwise, Jacob, always good having you on. Is there anything, any final words before you go shit your pants?
Nah, I'm going to go off and die now. So.
All right, moving on, we've got Pernell Vaughn joining us. Pernell, how are you doing?
I'm good. Cold. Really cold.
Are you shocked that you're not the first person on the episode?
I am not shocked because I got wind in advance from a special somebody. Who am I kidding? I had no idea, and I did not expect that. I was totally making that up. All of it.
Normally, we lead off with you, but this time you're batting second.
What did I do wrong? What did I do? I mean, I thought everything was square, man. You know, I show up, I do a little howdy, hey, you know, review some title titles, and it's a good time. You know,
I positioned it that way because we're going to have back-to-back Namco reviews, Bandai Namco reviews.
Ooh, what was the previous one?
Well, if you were listening to the show, which obviously you should have been doing, because as Jacob says, everyone's just in the same room. We're ready to go one after another. There is no cutting and editing at all. This is a seamless production.
Just right. Magic, baby. But, you know, because I was drinking and passed out during the previous reviews.
Ace Combat 7, baby.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I wasn't passed out. I actually did hear that review. It was apparently very good.
Yes, it was. Jacob liked it very much so. And I'm hoping that you will feel the same way about Tales of Vesperia.
Well, let's find out.
Let us indeed find out, because the next game to talk about tonight is called Tales of Vesperia Definitive Edition, developed by Namco Tales Studio, published by Bandai Namco, released January 11th on Xbox One, Switch, Steam, and PS4 for $49.99. A power struggle begins in a civilization dependent on an ancient technology, the Blastia, and the empire that controls it. The fates of two friends traveling separate paths intertwine in an epic adventure that threatens the existence of all. I've raved about this game tons of times on the show before, so I want to know, Purnell, what did you think of Tales of Vesperia?
Wait, you've played through this before?
On the 360.
Oh, well, that'll help a lot then, because I'm curious about if you think I'm on the right path with my frame of thought here. So,
well, it's been a while for me, so my old man brain might not remember as well. But I will do what I can to help out. I've only put about 5-10 hours into the re-release so far because I've had some other stuff come up that I had to work on. But I personally am loving this remaster of it. I think it looks great. It plays great. It is nice and smooth. But this is your review, not mine. So, Purnell, tell us about Tales of Vesperia.
Well, everything he just said, I said. Just assume I said it. But also, so one thing I've come to like about this one so far is that I think a lot of Tales games, you mentioned earlier, like the fate of the universe depends on what. Yeah, that's not new for these games. but I kind of like that the subplot of the game, so to speak, kind of involves a sort of dichotomy between like justice and absolute justice, in the sense of like what did you do, regardless of the law, is it worth doing something if it results in good, in a good outcome, so to speak. And leading the charge on that is the main character of the game, name is Yori Lowell, which, by the way, I didn't check, but if he's voiced by Yori Lowell, I thought it was pretty hilarious.
No, it's actually Troy Baker.
Oh, man, that'd have been such a good pair. Like,
oh, I know.
Was Yori Lowell. But he does a great job with the voice, though, because honestly, he's probably, so far even, just been one of my favorite main Tales characters probably ever. Just by his mannerisms and the way he acts. Even down to the battle, aside from the fact that his normal combo attack, if you've played Tales games, you know that the combat is sort of an action-style 2D game. Well, 2D-esque, when you're not running in the straight line, which they usually set you up on linear action battle system. It has like a kind of a combo main attack system that can feel sort of like a fighting game. And in the case of Yori, his combo, his main attack is like a sort of like 1-2-3 strike, but due to the fact that he has this cool flair where whenever he finishes up, he throws his sword over his back and catches it around the front, but it always leaves him open to get the crap kicked out of him while you're waiting for him to do it. But you adjust to it and you get better and you just accept the fact that he needs that flair to feel like a big man on the battlefield. But the way the game works, like, it starts out with the main character living in like what's pretty much the slums of like the main island's like imperial kingdom, and due to a series of misadvents involving some weirdo stealing the required core for their city to get clean water, he decides to go out to try to figure out who the guy is, where he is, beat the crap out of him, and get it back. And in the process, he goes through a series of misadventures where he meets new cast members and makes new friends and becomes more and more wanted by the law. And honestly, it's a very engaging tale. I enjoy hearing the character dialogue. I enjoy experiencing the adventure. And for the record, the skit system is pretty much back as expected. And what skits are in these games is as you're adventuring throughout the game and you're experiencing story events, every once in a while, you'll get a cue. And when you press, like, I guess it's the select button from the, I guess, what is it called on an Xbox controller anyway?
I think the view button.
When you press the view button, you'll get like a little vignette where it's like a bunch of like just character portraits, and then they'll actually spoken dialogue where they have a discussion about a certain event in the game. And honestly, they're very engaging. Sometimes it's very, like, you know, minute stuff such as, hey, why is your hair that color? You know, just have a conversation about that. But I think that adds a certain amount of charm. It doesn't always have to be about, you know, major events and things like that. It makes you kind of feel like as you're adventuring, these guys are getting to know each other and becoming friends. And that, to me, helps Tales games stand out far more as far as like character interactions go than other RPGs on the market, regardless of how you feel about their respective plot lines. So I enjoy engaging in those. Combat in the game is as fun as it's ever been. I enjoy the fact that you basically the gameplay in combat is sort of an evolved version of the Tales of Abyss battle system, where when you're in combat, it's a 3D environment, and you run left to right. But if you hold down the trigger button, you can go outside of that left to right format and run as, you know, 360 motion, go wherever you need to go. And then once you set down and you're ready to attack again, you set up in like another 2D motion, which is meant to make it easier for you to trigger and activate your special arts, which are, in this game, your special attacks. There's a button, I believe it is the, I look at my darn controller because I'm really bad at that. When you press the A button, you perform your arts moves. The A button and a direction performs a different arts move. Think like Smash Brothers Smash Attacks. And eventually you also are able to use the right thumbstick to shortcut four more moves. And attacks come in a variety of flavors. There are arts, like basic arts, arcane arts, mystic arts, and high arts. And the way the moves generally work is that you can use a base art and then combo. You use a normal combo, then use a base art, and then you combo it into a higher level, like advanced art or arcane art. So you start kind of doing that to kind of keep your combat flowing. But at one point, I started to complain, thinking that they dumbed down the combat. I knew that in other Tales games, there was a way for you to chain arts one after another. And in this game, that is still doable by way of something called Over Limits. Later on in the game, you unlock this feature. And what happens is, as you take and deal damage, you fill a gauge. And when all said and done, you're ready to roll, you press a button, and your character goes like a sort of like an overcharge mode for a short period of time, in which case, during that time, he can string any arts he wants without lagging cooldown, which means you can wrap up a nice meaty combo with tons of damage, and that feels really freaking good to do. One thing you'll have to expect in this game, if you've never played a Tales game, though, is that whereas most action RPGs, or RPGs in general, you kind of have control over everybody, and people are doing what you want them to do. But in this game, it's a very energetic and active combat, and all the characters are handled, aside from your main, of course, are all handled by the computer. So they're kind of doing their own thing, and admittedly, you can give them commands, so to speak, as like behaviors, like how to function, like use TP, conserve magic, conserve whatever. But for the most part, they're doing their own thing. With the exception of you occasionally be able to say, hey, I need to actually make you do a move, so I'm going to go into like the commands menu and just select that you do this thing right now. But for the most part, that takes a lot of getting used to, especially if you're someone like me who's a cocky bastard who wants to play on hard mode from the start and get the little bejeebies kicked out of him. Despite the fact that I've played tons of Tales games in the past, I still got my ass beat by the first boss in this game by switching too hard. So you might want to scale it back a bit, despite, regardless of whether or not you've been playing these games for ages or not. But I have really been enjoying this game quite a bit. It is a fantastic title. I like the characters. I kind of like the fact that one of the characters named Rita is voiced by Michelle Ruff, who also voiced the teacher Kawakami in Persona 5. So coming off of that game from nostalgia and then playing this game and hearing her talk in a very sarcastic way, just it's kind of a hilarious thing. So I'm like, I remember that character. It's a very I'm recalling this feeling of chatting with this character this exact way, and it's hysterical. But I'm trying to think of just thought. Oh, one thing I guess I like, I don't dislike it, so to speak, but if you're not familiar with how combat works, and you should at this point by hearing me discuss it just now, one of the staples of the game that you'll have to adjust to is the fact that combat is fast and furious. You'll be slinging and using special attacks left and right, and you'll be draining magic like the Dickens because of the fact that the meat and potatoes of the combat is stringing moves together and getting cool combos and special attacks. Mm-hmm. So you'll be using items, in this case they're called orange and pineapple gels and other types like that, to restore TP, and you're going to be probably using them rather liberally. So do not hesitate to buy tons of them whenever you can and just max them out, because you're going to use them, because why the heck not? There was an older Tales game where they actually got rid of that in favor of like a different chaining system, which I've always preferred. And if you're listening, Namco Bandai, and you could pass it back to the Japanese branch, tell them to make another game like Tales of Graces from Tales of Graces, where you just chain moves without TP. That was fantastic. But despite the fact that they just did away with that innovation, this is still a fantastic time and a great game with cool story, wonderful characters, and a solid battle system. I can't complain. Can you think of anything you didn't like about the original one?
About the original, no, but I do have a minor gripe about this definitive edition. And that is, of course, the definitive edition has a whole bunch of new content, two new characters, lots of extra content to play through. They did not get Troy Baker back to voice Yuri's additional line. So there is a sound alike. You might have noticed, I know it happens near the beginning, that he'll say a line that sounds just different enough that you could tell it's somebody else.
I did not notice, but now I feel like I need to go back to an old save file and check.
Yeah, it's even Troy Baker doesn't know why he wasn't called. He said he was hoping to be able to be a part of the definitive edition of it. I think it's a very minor gripe in what I feel is my favorite Tales game. It used to be Fantasia until Vesperia came out, but I fucking love Tales of Vesperia, and I'm thrilled that it got a re-release. I'm thrilled that it is available on all platforms, because Lord knows I was scared it was going to be a PS4 exclusive when it was announced.
Lord knows I'm sure that you can control a dog with a pipe in its mouth.
God damn right.
He's not a human dog. He is just a dog. But for some reason, he smokes a pipe and he has blades in his mouth. How does that work? I don't care. It's awesome.
It is awesome.
He's so great.
So $50 on Tales of Vesperia Definitive Edition. What is your verdict, Purnell?
I think it's a solid buy across the board, because if you've never played the game, then you really need to. And if you did play it in the past, and that was the last time you played it, as in when it first came out, they added enough new stuff to this that I feel like you're better off just like give it another dance and see what you miss, like see what they added and enjoy it anew with a fresh coat of paint and some fake Troy Baker lines.
Yeah, and check the store, because there's some free DLC for it with some starter packs, some upgrades, and a bunch of costumes as well. So free DLC is always good.
Would you refer to him as Troy Half Baker?
Troy Half Baker.
I was sitting on that.
Oh, God. Purnell, what am I going to do with you?
Oh, no. Give me more ammunition for puns.
Well, I'm sure the next game's title will have you rolling with puns or fun takes on the name of the game. The next game to talk about is called Piku Niku, developed by Sector Dub, published by Devolver Digital, released January 24th on the Switch and Steam for $12.99. Piku Niku is an absurdly wonderful puzzle exploration game that takes place in a strange but playful world where not everything is as happy as it seems. Help peculiar characters overcome struggles, uncover a deep state conspiracy, and start a fun little revolution in this delightful dystopian adventure. For now, how is Piku Niku?
Piku Niku is one of those games where you see it on the store, you see the price tag, and say, I'm not wasting money on this garbage. What is this? What is this? And guess what?
What? You're
crazy to do it with this game, because I took on the review, because this is one of those cases where you say, hey, you want to review this game? And I was like, I'll give it a shot, see what happens. And I came away with a wide smile on my face. This game is legit.
You worry me when you start off reviews like that.
I gotta keep you on your toes,
it's
man.
That bait and switch. It's like, this is a game that you're gonna look at and be like, man. And then you get it and it's like, eh. Yeah.
I was wrong about that.
I'm a dumb dumb.
Well, Piku Niku, the premise is more first and foremost, I gotta say,
it's a great name.
Second thing I gotta say, but the first thing, yes, that name is, I love it. It piques curiosity from the start. But the premise, the second thing I have to say, I guess, is that the intro to this game, I can't even spoil it because otherwise it won't have the same impact. I found the intro to be hysterical, humorous, and I want a screenshot of it because I need it as a wallpaper or something. I loved it. I loved the intro, and it got me very excited to see what the hell's going on this weird, colorful planet. But after the intro, what happens is you, the main character, wake up in a cave greeted by a little ghost man. He tells you, here's how to play the game. You should get out of here or something. So Piku Niku, I guess that's his name, because he never say his name. He's just a guy. He's a red guy with no arms and some long legs who can roll into a ball. He can use his leg as a grappling hook when he sees certain hooks, and he can kick things, and he can jump. That's the only things he can do. And he uses those abilities to get around the world and explore it. And once he eventually gets out of the cave, he is greeted by the local townsfolk who believe he is the so-called beast that they've been told about. But of course, Piku Niku, because that's what I'm going to call him, is cute and adorable and red. He is no beast, even though he does have the color of the beast. And that's okay, because you quickly prove to them that you are a cool dude by fulfilling certain various objectives to help the townspeople out. And then I won't spoil the game, because this game is one of those like sort of comically narrative-driven titles. But suffice to say, things get weird, things happen, and you're propelled through a hilarious narrative that ends with, well, I won't spoil that either. The point is, this is a fun game. It's a simple title in the sense that, like I said earlier, you use the abilities I mentioned earlier to fulfill objectives and to explore the world. And I will say that this is the kind of game that I appreciate when it comes to adventure titles. So they don't really outright say, go here, do this, go here, do this. They just said explore. And as you're exploring, things stand out. People tell you things. And then you get sub-objectives and things to do, which propel you to do those things, not because they're going to move the plot forward, but just because I should do that. I should see what happens when I do that. And it's almost like naturally strung together that when you do this thing, it results in this thing. And then you remember something you saw earlier that displayed an image that looked a lot like the thing you just got. And then you just know to go back and use it, which results in things happening, which moves the plot forward. It feels weird to say that, and you might be like, what the hell is Purnell talking about? But let me think. It's almost like, I don't know, walking down the street, and you see a door, like a house with a door, and like maybe on the walkway leading up to the house, you see a key on the ground. You know that key is likely for that door because you found the key within the vicinity of that home. It just kind of, it's just something you notice and you acknowledge and you know it's there. Now take that, but make it a little bit more of a wider world and have a similar outlook. You see a thing, could be 5 miles away, and you still know, wait, that totally goes to this thing over here. And in some cases, it's just bizarre in and of itself, like, because there's certain areas in the game where when you unlock them, they lead to sort of obstacle courses, I'll call them. Platforming challenges where, and at the end, there will be a reward. Sometimes the reward is a plot-related item. Sometimes it's just a weird thing that you just stumble across that may lead to something cool and weird later. Doesn't matter, though, because you want to do it. You want to get to the end. You want to see what happens. And the platforming challenges themselves are actually a lot of fun. I mean, once I got to the end of one, and all I gave me was a weird mask that, to my knowledge, does nothing. Nothing for the narrative. It's just, it's fun to do. You get to scare townspeople and be weird with it. But it never did anything that said, this is required to make the game progress. And I didn't care. Because, again, it was fun just to acquire the thing by going through the obstacle course that they set up for me to do. You'll have a lot of moments like that in the game. And the music, the color, the weird, wacky cartoon voices that they give them. Because they don't speak English. They speak gurgle.
What was that again?
Gurgle. But everything they do is just a joy. it feels good to listen to. The music isn't necessarily something that's going to be playing in your jukebox or your jukebox. Man, I'm old. In your MP3 player or in your car. But at the same time, it is one of those soundtracks where when you hear it in the game, you feel good. It makes you feel good to be playing the game. It resonates with you. And that, to me, is a fantastic game experience. Totally worth my time. And totally worth my money if I bought this. Which, honestly, if I heard myself talking about it in the past, I would have bought this. Because it's a great game. And well,
you can always buy it for me.
Let's talk shop. I just had to do my brakes and my oil. So, in fact, this is saving me the stress of wondering how to afford cool games.
You're welcome.
Talk apart. Thank you, sir.
Well, then overall, $13 on this one. What do you think of it?
I think it's totally worth the money. It's a short, but not too short, and sweet experience. Worth your time.
Awesome.
You better believe it, Pikuniku.
Pikuniku.
Got that weird strut he's got, too. Whenever he walks, his legs stretch out a little bit, and if he goes up hills, you see his legs stretch a little bit more to push him up the hill. It's so good.
Is it wrong to say Pikuniku, please?
It could be, but that's not what you said. And maybe they won't know what you're talking about. It might get you jumped in Compton, but...
Hey, whatever works, right?
You know you were coming from a good place when you said it.
Yeah, it's from the heart. Anyway, you got one last game to talk about. That is called Vane, developed and published by Friend and Foe, released January 15th, exclusive on the PS4 for $24.99, set out on an epic story of transformation where shifting between the perspectives of a bird and a child will be the key to unravel the land's mysteries and create a path forward through the barren landscape. As you do so, the remnants of the world react to your passage, evolving and building into something altogether different. Pernell, what is this game?
Vane, it's going to feel weird to say this, because especially after you just heard how I led the other review, but I feel like Vane does the opposite of what Pikuniku did. They're both adventure games, just different types of adventure games. And the way that Vane handles the exploration is going to be hit or miss depending on what kind of person you are, what kind of stuff you're into. So the game starts out with a child running in the dark at night with lightning striking all over the place. Things are scary, and you're trying to figure out what the hell's going on. So you control the main character. He tries to go to a lighthouse, which seems to be like a lighthouse of sorts. And as he tries to get in, he gets knocked out the door. He's not allowed in, and he gets swallowed up by the darkness that was chasing him. And then the next scene, you're a raven or a crow or a black bird of some sort in the middle of a desert. And you are tasked with controlling this bird by way of flight. And flying the bird is a lot of fun, actually. I experienced a great deal of joy during those earlier moments of controlling the bird and just kind of getting a hang of like gliding and flying in place and things of that nature. But then, after you've gotten past the whole, wow, I'm controlling this cool flying bird, you're then left in a really big desert with no idea what you're supposed to do. And I mean, none. I mean,
it's kind of like Journey, but with a bird.
I think you may be right there. I think you actually are right there. And depending on how Journey portrays for people, maybe I'll reflect on this, because what ends up happening is there are objectives and things to fulfill. I'm not going to say what they are, because quite honestly, solving these things are what the game actually is. But for this entire large world you get, for the most part, you're kind of left to think, hey, I got to find something. I got to find anything that will give me an indication that I need to go somewhere. And you usually end up, you eventually will come across some things that stand out, like, you know, a body of water or like, another body of water. What ends up happening is you, the player, have to kind of piece together what the hell's going on and what's going to trigger the next event. What do I need to do to press forward? And during this desert sequence, it's kind of odd because There's a lot to explore and yet nothing to explore at the same time, because it's a large area, but it's also a wasteland. So there's like a lot of just desolate land, and then occasionally you might see like a cool cave you can fly into, but then the cave is desolate. So you're like, ugh, what am I doing in here? I guess I better fly back out. And what ends up happening is you find yourself wanting to explore because the game seems to indicate that it wants you to explore. Yet there's not a lot that you want to see that's out there to be found. So you're just kind of hoping you piece together the puzzles required to progress to the next sequence. And once you've fulfilled that request, the game then leads you to, like, I guess the main mechanic that you mentioned in your description, which is that you come across gold dust. And whenever the bird flies into the gold dust, it coats him and he becomes a boy. And as a boy, whereas the bird can fly around and use like a bird call to trigger the actions of other birds for various reasons, the boy can run, sort of run. He's more like kind of hobbling. He can jump and he can manipulate things with his hands. Like he can pull levers and push, you know, rocks and walls and stuff like that. And you'll be eventually using combinations of the boy form and the bird form to solve puzzles. Now, when you are actually in the motion of solving things, like when you actually see, I got to do this thing, I got to solve this puzzle to move forward, at that point, you feel engaged. Because again, I like controlling the bird. And even when the boy can be a pain in my ass, it's not a game killer. Because he can be a pain in the ass to control sometimes. But when you're not aware of what you need to do, and you're just kind of fumbling in the dark, literally in the dark in some cases, to figure out where you want to go, that's the parts that are the downtime. And the parts that I feel like it may sort of almost artificially extend the length of the game. Because, of course, you're just kind of wandering in the dark trying to figure what the hell you want to do. Versus, you know, having that momentum going. You know what I'm talking about when I say that, right? Like, you know, certain stories are like, okay, I want to see what's going to happen next. What's going on? I need to evolve to the next scene.
Yeah.
But I didn't get there. Now I'm stuck. I'm losing the edge of the interest. So with that in mind, I did enjoy getting things right. I enjoyed actually knowing what I wanted to do and going through the motions to solve the problems that I needed to solve to accomplish what I needed to accomplish. But it was getting to the point of discovering those things to get to that next sequence that drove me freaking bonkers. And especially during the desert sequence, that to me was probably the part that almost drove me away from the entire game. But I will say, once you get past that, the momentum gets a little bit better because it feels like it's a little bit more contained. And the puzzle, while still larger environments, is not as large as the desert was. And it's easier to try to get a handle of what you need to do and how to progress. And at that point, I think the game becomes a bit better. So, but that desert was a really weird way to start the game. And I actually, admittedly, I'm not even going to lie, I went on the internet and looked around because I wanted to see if other people who were talking about this game were thinking about the same thing I was, which is that this game gives you no direction. What the hell's going on? And I will say this. There are the occasional twinkly bits out in the desert. So keep your eye out for stuff like that. When I was playing it, I noticed the twinkly bit 2 times out of the multiple times I needed to actually see them. But if you can spot those, you may well have an easier time of sorting out that initial sequence than I did. So just wanted to point that out in the review proper. So it's hard to gauge how I feel about the game as a whole, which probably makes it more of a try it than anything else, because it's definitely not a throwaway title by a long shot. And I wouldn't even call it a bad game. It's just a matter of, it's a very acquired taste title that requires you to be okay with kind of wandering aimlessly for a bit until you figure out what you need to do to progress the game on your own.
Gotcha.
No, you don't. You're like, what the hell did that man just say?
It just seems to me like missed potential.
I think that sounds about right. Like, I feel like that's a good way to put it. Exactly. Like it could have been more. Like, imagine if that wandering desert had more landmarks. Then even with them saying, you know, we want you to figure it out for yourself, it won't feel as bad because there's more to find. There's more to see. You know, we've all played games like that where it's just like a wide, expansive environment. And it's just cool to find things. What was it? That one game I played on the Switch months ago, the Yonder. That game was kind of like a violence-free Wind Waker,
mm-hmm.
Or violence-free Breath of the Wild or whatever. That game is a prime example of what I'm talking about. There's a lot that's just out there for you to do, and you may wander aimlessly for a while. And this game, again, has no violence, no combat. But as you're out there, you constantly see yourself going, what's on that ridge? What's over there? Can I smash that rock and get some stuff out of it? There's a lot going on to make you go, I'm enjoying the wandering component. So that when I eventually get to the story part, I might not even care because I'm too busy wandering part. And I think that's the thing that hurts this game more than anything else. It's just the wandering isn't enjoyable. It's the solutions that are.
Yeah. There's just not enough to do to keep you involved and engaged.
Yeah. Or not, more so not enough to see.
Yeah. Well, then overall, your official verdict at $25.
I'm going to go with a try it for that. Though I will say, if I had to choose between of the two adventure games I did this episode, Pikuniku. Pikuniku, man, is a quality smile on your face good time. But this is definitely at least a try it by far. It's like, but like I said, if you're okay with what I just said, as far as like how the exploration and all that stuff works, go for it. I think you'll find a good time in there.
Awesome. Pernell, always good having you on chatting about these games. Do you have any final thoughts to sum it up before we move on?
Not so much, actually. Just
nothing this week?
Nothing. I'm riding on fumes, man. I'm trying to get these games in. Next week is going to be a killer. We got Resident Evil coming up, and we got freaking, what's that other game? Kingdom Hearts, which means that'll be my cue to play Dream Drop Distance finally. Oh, God. I'm just riding the waves of like of game releases here. It's nuts. And of course, as you know, that means no sleep. So that's where all the ramblings come from. Enjoy, folks.
All right. And last up tonight, we are being joined by our friend Chris Taylor. Chris, how are you doing?
Hey, doing all right.
How was your weekend?
I can't remember it, so it must have been all right. Oh, yeah, yeah. I played lots of video games.
Are you back to your Skyrim indulgence? No.
Well, I mean, I was until I got this big pile of games, and I had to take a break. But I did play, I'm playing through the second Discworld game with a friend of mine. I think I mentioned it in a previous episode because we played through the first game too, but I bought a PlayStation mouse for the purposes of this point and click, you know, adventure game about British wizards. But it's a it's a Tomimeki Memorial Special Edition mouse. That was the cheapest one they had, and so it's got, you know, Tomimeki Memorial, of course, is a dating sim, and so it's just got like this, you know, cute anime girl on the mouse. Which is, it's quite the treasure. But yeah, we've been doing that, and just been playing these games mostly.
Yeah, you got a lot of games to talk about tonight.
We got a few of them, yes.
You got more than a few, but let's start things off. Fairy Fencer F Advent Dark Force, developed by Compile Heart and Idea Factory, published by Idea Factory International, released January 17th on the Switch for $39.99. Three stories, three paths, and three branching stories. Friends become foes, foes become friends, and based on your choices, multiple endings can be unlocked. Will you revive the goddess or the vile god? Your choice will reshape the world. Chris, what did you do?
Well, I haven't revived either of them yet because that's the end of the game.
I've been
working on the goddess. Yeah, the game gives you an option. Basically, I guess, this goddess and this, the vile god, which is, I don't know, maybe it's an unfair title. Maybe it, according to his moral system, he's a good god. I don't know. But, he definitely looks nasty, so they stuck a bunch of swords in both of them. I guess I don't really know what the deal is with the swords, but they trap both these gods. There's like 100 swords in each of them. And the swords are actually called Furies, and the Furies are powered by fairies. And so the point of the game is that you play a guy who becomes a fencer, which is a fencer is somebody who works with a fairy to collect furies in order to extract these swords and their power from either of the two gods. You just straight up have a choice. Although they tell you, they're like, I don't understand why anybody would want to revive the vile god, but you know, you could do that.
See, that would make me want to revive the vile god.
I mean, there's always subsequent playthroughs, so
true.
I might, you know, make some different choices, but yeah. So this game is it's hard to put it with one other kind of RPG, but it is a straight up turn based, menu based RPG thing where you run around in 3D space and You also, a little bit like Dragon Quest XI, you're free to roam within battles, but the turns are still done in menu style. But in this game, where you move determines whether you're in range for an enemy attack or whether they're going to be in range for your attack. So there's a little bit of chess involved, but, you know, honestly, it's mostly just running at the enemies and hitting the attack button. But this game gives you a whole lot of other stuff to do as far as, like, what you can do in battles, and you'll kind of need it because they really throw some high HP stuff at you early on, so you really have to figure out how to power up. And the way this game does it is through a thing called Fair Eyes, which they have a kind of hilarious dialogue about how ridiculous that name is. Because it's like fairy-izing yourself. Basically, your fairy turns into a sword and stabs you, and then you become super-powered. Might remind you a little bit of one of the Persona games where you have to shoot yourself in the head to get superpowers.
Yeah, I was going to say Spider-Man.
Or Spider-Man, yes. Even more, you know, contemporary. So yeah, and then once you superpower yourself into this silly, like, almost Gundam looking thing, the music changes to like this crazy J-rock, and then, you know, you're much more superpowered and you can use special moves. It really becomes like a Megazord sort of situation. Like, you've got so much other stuff you can do only when you're in your ridiculous cosplay form. And ridiculous it is. This game is way over the top on its attacks and its graphics and its, like, flashiness, and I really enjoy that. But what I truly enjoyed about this game is just is the writing, because the writing and the voice acting, because it's that. And, you know, if you know Compile Heart and you've, you know, played a few of their games, then you might recognize it, but it's basically. Oh, and by the way, I have reviewed a Compile Heart game before. It was that Mary Skelly's Nightmare, if you remember, on the PSP from like 2 years ago.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is same company.
Nice.
Yeah. So the voice acting is that kind of like camp that you'll be laughing at with friends and like quoting endlessly, because some of it's really bad, but it's also just effective enough. It's just campy, you know? And I love campy voice acting. It's my bread and butter when it comes to RPGs. And I mean, you know, if you're not going to hire a bunch of, you know, British comedians to voice your game, like in the Discworld games, then you might as well just go whole hog with the absurdity. And this game doles out lots of absurdity. Your main character, I love him because he is motivated by nothing but food. when he first meets his fairy. I can
sympathize with this character.
Yes. He's a skinny layabout called Fang, who believes himself to be God's gift to women, but also doesn't actually want to do anything but sleep and eat. He just recognizes that he's extremely handsome. That is up for debate, of course. But when Fang meets Aaron, who is the fairy, who not a like tiny fairy like in usual lore, this is a full-size woman who might have wings. We can't really even tell. because all the characters are just like that kind of, it's a still shot of the character portrait, but it kind of moves like it's breathing, but that's all it does. Like, there's no real action that's seen on screen apart from just other character portraits, like different poses and such. But like, if somebody's eating, it'll just be the character standing there and the voice actor will imitate eating, you know? Like, that's kind of how the dialogue goes. It's not face-to-face type stuff. So when he meets Aaron, you know, she's like, she goes into her, like, you know, spiel about justice and how he's the chosen fencer and how they must form a partnership and defeat evil and all this other stuff. And like three different times he thinks that he's summoned a genie that will give him food, so he asks for food. He's like, as your master, I command you to give me food. And like, when she, you know, she keeps turning him down because that's just not how the situation works, because, you know, he just pulled out this sword and that's what summoned her, you know, because this is anime. And And then eventually he just steals some food because he thinks he can get away with that because he has a special sword. And then he gets put in jail, and that's where you start the game.
Hmm.
So he's a profoundly stupid character. And I love him so much. And then you meet like this just batshit insane woman who is like part love interest and again part sort of, I don't even know, like she's sort of just kind of using you to get at the Furies because she takes her Furies hunting very seriously, but then alternately she's like in love with the character, usually when he insults her, which is often. And then there's just other characters. There's this lady who, she hasn't joined my party yet, but I imagine she's going to because she's also a fencer. Every fencer has a fairy, by the way. And this particular character only speaks with the word kill, and then her fairy translates for her, and it's actually really hilarious. Like, she'll get, like, a full sentence out of just one kill.
Nice.
So the girl's like, kill, kill, kill. And then she's like, eh. What she says is, you know, Ethel is her name. It's like, Ethel says that I find your appearance degrading, blah, 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 and, you know, all this other stuff.
Nice.
And then, yeah. So this game is really interesting. Like, I actually really want to see more of the story because it's both absurd and kind of, like, really cliche. Like, there's some really cliche anime stuff in here. But also, it's actually well-written. Like, it intentionally makes jokes that hit home. And it's very, I think it's self-aware. It's not, like, just, you know, like a Psycho game or something like that. Just, you know, badly translated or you know, otherwise just, you know, oh, that's good enough, just put that out there, and it ends up being ridiculous. This game actually has some intention behind the ridiculousness. For instance, like in various RPGs of this ilk, you can purchase armor, and then you can purchase separately pieces of costume. That is to say, you can change your clothes and your overall appearance in the game only in the field and in battle. It doesn't change anything in the cutscenes because they're all sprite-based. Or portrait-based, but one of the first things that you can purchase for the main hero initially is a piece of toast for him to have in his mouth, and it says perfect for when you're late for the bus. So it calls upon that anime trope, and then later on you can buy burnt toast.
Oh,
and you could just run around this entire game with burnt toast in your mouth if you wish.
That sounds fantastic.
And what a game, by the way, because, okay, so my copy, I'm not sure if all the copies do this, but mine came with some bonus content that might either be DLC or something that's tacked onto this new edition, because this is actually a game from 2013. This is just like a special re-release HD special edition type deal. One of the things I got was some bonus dungeons, and that one of the bonus dungeons has a recommended level for conquering it between 750 and 999.
So it'll be a while before you get there.
Yes. So clearly this game is designed with people who like to overplay games in mind. And so for that reason, although I'm, you know, I'm pretty good distance in now, but obviously, I mean, I've only had this game for a little while. I'm definitely going to be playing through the main storyline on this and maybe even tackling some bonus dungeons. So I'm expecting to spend a long time with this one.
Nice. So overall $40 on it. What's your verdict?
Well, $40, that's a little more expensive than the other releases, right? I was kind of looking around.
Switch game. I figure it's kind of on par.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably because it's going to have a physical release. And if so, then, you know, that's definitely a good way to go on this one. For $40, I've definitely played worse RPGs. I'd say that this is definitely a full-on RPG that is worth your time, and it has a lot of other content in it I didn't even go into. You know, you do have to have a little bit of a taste for the absurdity that comes along with some of these more anime-inspired games, particularly, you know, ones that'll just launch into a full J-Rock vocal theme in the middle of a battle for seemingly no reason. Oh, and actually one thing I mentioned that was super surprising, the design art or the character artwork, I think, and or at least he's credited as one of the, you know, artistic designers. It's Yoshitaka Amano from Final Fantasy.
Oh, wow.
And Nobuo Uematsu and the Black Mages do some of the soundtrack.
Oh, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, the game overall has about five composers, but seeing two big, like, names associated with Final Fantasy, I was like, oh, wow, this game's actually, it's got some pedigree.
Yeah.
It just wasn't expected, because once the story gets started, and you're like, what is this? you know, but then you get drawn into it, and you're, and, you know, like any good anime, it's eventually going to get, like, super serious, and, you know, one's going to feel feelings about it. But right now, it's all about leading a goofy dude that wants food.
Nice. Sounds good.
Which is me. Yeah. I recommend this one, basically. I say yes. Yes, buy it.
I might have to grab that one. It sounds really cool.
Yeah, I am really enjoying it so far.
Awesome. Speaking of enjoying things, you had a chance to enjoy a couple of Arcade Archives titles from our friends at Hamster. Not one, not two, but five.
I thought you were going to go through every number.
No, I figured I would just jump to it. There's only so much time in a show. We're limited here.
It's true. Yeah, we're gonna turn on the kitchen timer on this one and try and get through these pretty quickly, because some of these are going to be ones that y'all are already going to kind of know what to expect.
Yeah, like this first one, Arcade Archives Excitebike, originally developed by Nintendo, Switch version developed and published by Hamster, released September 21st on the Switch for $7.99. Excitebike is a motorcycle racing game released by Nintendo in 1984. In addition to solo qualifying races, there are final races where you face off against motocross riders. Each course has its own variety of obstacles. Use all your techniques to avoid the obstacles as you aim for first place. How is it?
Okay, so this is the original arcade version of Excitebike. So there's like four different versions of Excitebike. And most people in the States are only going to recognize the original NES game, which had, you know, selection A, selection B, and then like a course design mode that didn't work. That is to say, it didn't save because the cartridge didn't have a battery. It was a Famicom disk system thing.
Yeah.
So people who are more familiar with Excitebike Versus will recognize this one, because it's basically, that's what it is. Unfortunately, not the Excitebike Versus on the Famicom Disk System, which has a full-on, like, jazzy soundtrack by Soya Oka of Mario Kart fame. That one, sadly, is still, you know, a Japanese exclusive. So what this is this is the original Excitebike, upon which all the other versions are based. The main difference you're going to notice in this one between it and the NES game, it looks exactly the same, except that it's got that, you know, big bright arcadey look, but the sprites are all the same. Because this is a pre-Mario Nintendo product, you know, it's not as elaborate as all that. But basically, the way that races are set up in this one, instead of just being five races against, you know, countless other motorcycles, it is seven rounds split into two parts. And the first part is a qualifying round where you just run a race by yourself and try and, you know, make a good time. And if your time qualifies you for the actual race, then you race the actual race. And that's against, you know, initially four other opponents, although as soon as you pass them up, you know, others appear in the frame, a little bit like F-Zero.
Yeah.
Like just the endless supply of other racers. So in fact, your rank is based on your time rather than how many motorcycles you get ahead of, if that makes any sense. And then, yeah, once you do that, then, you know, you get your place until you lose. And once you lose, then it plays the classic, goofy, you know, title music from the NES game, because there is actually no title music to the original Excitebike, but you will hear the famous, you know, yeah, as made famous by many bands at this point.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, the way that Excitebike goes, if you don't know, it's just a side-scrolling racer with, you know, it's got four different layers to the course, and you can switch between them. You run your bike up hills and make sure to land. Like, you basically can speed yourself up by you know, turning your nose down, you have, you know, full control over tilting your bike. But if you don't land on both wheels, then you'll end up spinning out of control, and then you have to, you know, get back on your bike and keep going, which will make you lose lots of time. And it's beyond that, it's really just a go from left to right until you win kind of situation. So
it's classic Excitebike.
It is classic Excitebike, and I do actually think this version plays better than the NES version, and the courses make more sense, and there's no course design mode, which is good, because, again, that was broken on the NES version.
Well, then, $8, what do you think?
$8, I mean, this is a must-try on... for, you know, anybody seeking that classic Nintendo, you know, black cartridge experience. So Excitebike's one of the better games they put out. It is the first and final. No, it's not the final game in the programmable series, is it? Like, they had like one of the others. Anyway, it's whatever. It's Excitebike. So yeah, you should pick it up. This is very faithfully recreated, and there's a lot of cool little options that you can select to make the thing go a little smoother. So...
awesome. Going from one of the best of the NES releases to, honestly, one of the worst. Next game to talk about is called Arcade Archives Urban Champion. Yes, they released it. Originally developed by Nintendo. Switch version developed and published by our friends at Hamster. Released November 9th on the Switch for $7.99. Urban Champion is a beat-em-up fighting game first released by Nintendo in 1984. True to its namesake, fighting men duke it out fist-to-fist for the title of Urban Champion. Go into battle with light and heavy punches as well as dodging and other defensive maneuvers, which sounds a lot fancier than this game really is.
I take it you're not a fan of Urban Champion.
I'm not a fan of Urban Champion.
Aw.
Are you?
Well, I mean, look, I like it, but it's like Excitebike. There's just not a whole lot to it. It's a pre-Mario.
I loved Excitebike, though. It kept me coming back to play for more. Urban Champion, you play it once and you're good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, you know, so it's yeah... basically one of the only one-on-one fighters for that early of an ilk. Like, I think the only other one is Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters, and then, you know, of course, a Joy Mecha fight in Japan, but those are way later, like 10 years later, in fact. So yeah, this is it's a unique thing. I think that it probably didn't age as well as Nintendo would have wanted it to. Certainly, the characters have never come back in anything apart from, like, Smash Bros. Trophies, which is funny that that's one of Nintendo's most successful things now is fighting games, if you think about it. So, yeah, Urban Champion, it's basically, yeah, two dudes start on either side of an apartment building, and you got to try and punch the other guy in his open spot, also while... blocking or, you know, canceling out a punch that's coming at you, either low or high. And yeah, once you get him to the other side of the screen, he rolls away, and then you go into another screen. And then at the end of three screens, if you've, you know, or actually it's at, when the other character has rolled out of a screen enough times, a manhole will appear that you have to knock him into. For whatever reason, it's absolutely necessary in a street fight, in a real honest urban brawl, to throw the other guy into the sewers in order to consider yourself winning. But yeah, I mean, that's all it is. It's just punching in front of buildings. The buildings all look the same, but the names change from like barbershop to discount shop to bookstore. And,
yeah, lots of variety.
Yeah. And funny enough, if you get knocked back a screen, right, and then you win the next round and knock that guy back a screen, but then he knocks you back down a screen, suddenly the manhole will appear there where it wasn't before. So it's not a game that's super consistent with reality. But yeah, like, you win some rounds, you lose some rounds. You know, the game's over when you lose. You can win seemingly endlessly. I actually got really far, and just eventually the other guys just get too smart and too strong, and they'll overpower you and take your quarter. So that's Urban Champion. This version versus the NES version has a better soundtrack, which actually plays while you're fighting, which is nice, rather than just being, you know, punch, punch, and bloop, bloop. apart from that, there's no real extra, you know, content that was cut from the arcade version to get into the NES version. I mean, it's pretty much pitch perfect. So. Yeah. if you like the idea of an extremely simplistic fighting game, then this one's for you.
Well, $8, your official verdict?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of going with you on this one in that it's not an essential NES experience or early arcade experience. It is just kind of there. This game is really one that if you're nostalgic for it, then yes, sure, go for it. It's certainly recreated really well by Hamster. So if you are going to play Urban Champion, this is the version to get. If you don't want to play Urban Champion, then I totally understand.
If you don't want to play Urban Champion, we got three more games to talk about.
And one of them is a good brawler, so let's...
Speaking of, next game to talk about is Arcade Archives Double Dragon 2, developed and published by Hamster, released December 6th on the Switch for $7.99. Double Dragon 2 The Revenge is an action game that was released by Technos Japan in 1989. In order to avenge Lover, oh my god.
Yeah.
Billy and Jimmy will use their signature moves to challenge the armed groups of the mystery. Yes, that's what it says. In this game, users can use a variety of skills than previous work Double Dragon and enjoy scuffles that are power up.
That's amazing. That's some amazing copy.
Yeah, so Double Dragon 2, how is it?
All right, so Double Dragon 2, this is another game that folks who grew up on the NES will recognize. Certainly, Double Dragon 2 is my favorite of the original trilogy. The first game, a little too stiff. Didn't quite know what it wanted to be because it had the one-on-one fighting aspect too. Double Dragon 3, total train wreck.
God, yeah.
Nobody likes it. I'm sure I would like it if I played it enough, but I didn't grow up with it. I only tried it once and put it away forever. So.
Good move.
Double Dragon 2 is the sweet spot of Double Dragon experiences, except for the marvelous Double Dragon 4, or whatever it's called, that I reviewed like 2 years ago, which I actually really, really like. But this is the original arcade game upon which the sequel is based, and thus it actually, you know, it moves a little bit different than the NES counterpart. And in fact, this one swaps stage themes, so you actually start off with stage 2's stage theme and stage 1, and vice versa, I noticed.
You're dropping knowledge.
Hey, I mean, I've covered this soundtrack before with D&D, so I totally, like, spent a lot of time with Double Dragon 2, like, learning its ins and outs. But apart from that, you know, the bosses are the same, all the sprites are bigger, they look better. The controls are a little bit better, and in fact, Hamster was nice enough to include an option to make the spin kick, which is an essential move for certain bosses. They made it easier to utilize. It was actually a little harder in the original arcade version. It basically involved like jumping and then alternating sides on a control, but on this one you can actually just jump and then push both of them or something like that at the same time. It ended up being a lot easier to use the move, so I was really happy that they thought to include that. And of course you can set it to the original version as well, and I'm sure maybe they added an option to make it even harder. I don't know.
Why not?
I only ever explore the options that make games easier. Speaking of easier, in Double Dragon 2, of course, in all the Double Dragons, you're severely limited by the amount of, you know, lives that you have, because in order to translate an arcade experience to a home experience, obviously they had to make extra challenge, so they only gave you so many quarters. In this game, of course, you can Rich Kid blast your way all the way through the game, no problem. Dump in 30 quarters and then just, you know, keep adding them in.
Nice.
So this is a game that you absolutely can finish from start to end, like, if you only just push those shoulder bumpers.
Well, then $8, what do you think?
I mean, you know, for sure, if you are a Double Dragon aficionado, this is a great arcade game, and so it's one that I definitely recommend picking up. if you're not, if you're just like looking at, you know, things like Renegade and Urban Champion and Double Dragon and being like, well, what's the deal with all these brawlers? Double Dragon 2 is definitely closer to the top of the heap. This one is worth playing if you don't know what it is. Oh, that yeah. is to say, you won't load it up like Renegade and be like, why can't I get past the first level ever? This one's really fun. Two player, of course, so you know that's always good. And again, it's one that you can actually beat. Yeah, because you know, thank God for current, you know, arcade ports.
Unlimited coins.
This one is a buy it.
Sweet. Next up is ACA Neo Geo Metal Slug 4, developed and published by Hamster, released August 9th on Xbox One, PS4, and Switch for $7.99. Metal Slug 4 is an action shooting game released by SNK in 2002, and it marks as the fifth title in the Metal Slug series, which is great because it's called 4, but it's number 5. Yeah, in addition to Marco and Fio, the brand new characters Trevor and Nadia have also joined the battle. Chris, tell us about it.
Okay, so if you've never played a Metal Slug game, then you know I will describe them for you. But if you have played a Metal Slug game, this is a Metal Slug game. That's all you need to know. No, like Metal Slug, yeah, it's a long-standing Neo Geo series of run and guns, which is, you know, think Contra or Gunstar Heroes is a good one to think of for this one. It's a series that started in the mid to late 90s, so the sprite work in them is beautiful. They're funny. They have really cool, like, giant machines that you get to fight. And, of course, the ever-present hippie POWs. That is to say, POW. All the POWs have, like, the really long hair and really long beards. And when you rescue them, it gives you items. And, of course, if you make it to the end of the stage without getting a game over, then they give you lots and lots of bonus points. However, this is, again, a game that you can just dump quarters into until you finish it. So you don't actually have to do any of that. That is all just for score. But this is a fun enough game, and it's forgiving enough that you actually will try to get through it, you know, based on your actual skills that you develop.
It's fucking Metal Slug. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, exactly. And so the difference here for 4, so each Metal Slug kind of has like a little bit of a difference to it. You know, 1, of course, is the original version. You only had 2 characters. You know, player 1 is the dude, player 2 is the lady. They added the 2 more characters that are more ever-present in the series in 2 and 3, and then 4... just straight up replaced the additional 2 characters with 2 other characters who, you know, they're all kind of the same, so it doesn't really matter. I don't even remember their names, and you just said them. and then, you know, 5, I actually haven't played 5 yet, but, you know, 5 seems to rely a little bit more on, like, gimmicky levels, and then... 6 is the only one that's not currently available on Switch. Actually, every Metal Slug right now is available on Switch. And yeah, the numbering order goes 1, 2, X, 3, 4, 5, 6. So X is just a remake of 2, and it really messes with the numbering system. But the other thing about this game is that it introduces a kind of cool score multiplier. Really, if you're gonna start with Metal Slug somewhere, because the stories are all kind of the same, it's these army guys against a Dr. Wily style villain who keeps appearing in the different stages. And by the way, there's always a mini boss in every Metal Slug that, even though you always murder him on screen, he shows up in every game. Which is kind of funny to me.
Nice.
But anyways, and that's just the kind of cool, like, little Easter eggy stuff that shows up in these kind of games. 4, so 1, you know, started off as serious, you know, armies fighting armies, you know, rescuing POWs and defeating the military madman. 2 and 3 kind of jumped the shark a little bit by bringing in aliens and, you know, Yetis and things like that. Just all these different kinds of weird things that started happening. And then 4, although 4 does have a stage that does have Yetis in it, it's kind of a return to form, but with all the innovations that 2 and 3 introduced. So 4 is a good starting point if you're not familiar with the Metal Slug series, just for the fact that it's not one of the, like, bizarre games. Although the bizarre games are more interesting, I'd say, overall. At least, like I said, 4 retains their innovations and gives you the other characters to use. But honestly, I mean, recommending one Metal Slug over all the others is a waste. You just got to play them all. They're all very fun. Like I said, it's really fast, smooth, collecting, you know, weapons that that'll, you know, bring the big explosions. Shooting guys, and in this game you can actually turn on blood mode. That's in the hamster options. There's actually, typically the arcades would have blood mode turned off. Everybody would just kind of explode into whiteness. But in this one they explode into redness, which is
thanks,
cool.
Hamster.
Thanks, hamster. You brought back the gore.
So $8 on Metal Slug 4.
Yeah, go ahead and get it. In fact, go ahead and get you a pile of Metal Slug games. Gosh, Hamster's done really well in bringing all of them but one to the Switch, and you know they'll get to that other one eventually. You just know it.
Yeah, probably.
Yep.
All right, final game to talk about tonight: ACA Neo Geo Prehistoric Isle 2, developed and published again by Hamster, released August 2nd on Xbox One, PS4, and Switch for $7.99. Prehistoric Isle 2 is a shooting game released by SNK in 1999. Various types of dinosaurs, which are large, small, or even have the wings emerged. Your mission is to eliminate these primeval beasts from the city. Chris, wrap it up for us.
All right, Prehistoric Isle 2. I was actually really excited about this one. It's been on my wish list for right up until I got it to review.
6 months.
Yeah. okay, so the cool thing about this is that it's a sequel to a game that we get to experience now on the Switch, because the fantastic SNK 40th Anniversary Collection includes the original Prehistoric Isle. But it, you know, it is obtainable in some other forms too, but I was just excited because I had played the original very recently and beaten it. And the original was, you know, it was a kind of a gimmicky biplane shooter where, you know, you had an R-type style, like guided, partner sphere that like you had to sort of position in a certain way in order to utilize like a second shot, blah blah blah. It's very kind of tricky but interesting. This game eliminated that. It is a straight up horizontal shooter. The biplanes have been replaced by helicopters, and you have your choice between two pilots, both dudes, of course. And yeah, so I guess the plot doesn't really connect so much with the original Prehistoric Isle. Like, the original Prehistoric Isle was kind of interesting because it was, you know, every stage was called an inquiry because you were investigating disappearances at the Bermuda Triangle. But, I mean, you figure out immediately that there's an island full of dinosaurs that you have to blow up, including the end boss, which is a literally 426-foot-long T-Rex. That is the dimensions the game actually gives you. So that's your, you know, the first game was like really cool like that. The second game, a little more random in that. I won't spoil what the last boss is, but it's certainly no T-Rex or dinosaur. But for the most part, you're fighting against dinosaurs who can shoot lasers at you for whatever reason. And the real difference on this one is that now you can help people. That is to say, there will be people like, because the dinosaurs have, you know, gone all sorts of, you know, haywire, and they've infiltrated like cities. So you actually start off in a city, Jurassic Park 2 style, and, you know, eventually make your way back to, you know, a volcano and then other parts. You know, because the volcano factors into the original game too. But yeah, so there will be people like kind of standing around and saying, help me. And then you have to collect them with your helicopter, and then they cling to the outside of the helicopter, which is a bad idea. And if your helicopter blows up and you lose a life, then you'll lose. If you have like, let's say, 2 people, one of them will actually fall to his death, but the other one can be caught midair and rescued anew. And of course you got to get these people to safety, which is either at the end of the stage or there'll be another rescue helicopter that meets you like halfway through the stage. So of course helping as many people as possible is a tertiary goal. The primary goal, of course, is just to blow up all the dinosaurs. And you know, in fact, each stage, apart from one, I think, will have a thing where about 30 people will be climbing into a rescue helicopter, and you have to keep the dinosaurs off their backs, you know, defending them sort of tower defense style, except that it's, you know, just a basic shooter. So yeah, apart from that, it's one of those kind of games like Aerofighters or anything like that, where you collect power-ups and that gives you, you know, a sort of powered up, spread out version of whatever gun you're using. There's two different kinds. One's like kind of a laser beam and the other one's your spread shot, which of course is my favorite. And yeah, apart from that, it's just, it's standard shooter fare. It's, you know, at the end of the stage, there's going to be some kind of huge dinosaur thing or something that didn't look like a dinosaur at all. It was just kind of an alien lizard guy that, you know, just went without explaining. You know, the game kind of confuses itself sometimes, it seems, in this way. Graphics are presented instead of the, you know, 1989 big colorful sprite style that the original Prehistoric Isle utilized. This one uses a more sort of Killer Instinct gold and, you know, sort of the rendered 3D look, you know.
Yeah.
You can actually tell from the preview screens it looks like a game that was made in 1999 for sure. But ultimately, it's about shooting dinosaurs with helicopters and saving people, and what's not to love about that?
Very true. So $8?
Yeah, $8. I say go ahead and get it, and also, you know, go get that SNK collection as well and play the original. The original is super unfair and extremely taxing, but, you know, you can quarter your way through it. This game you can also quarter your way through. Certainly I beat it, but it's a lot more forgiving and you're able to sort of hang with it a lot more. You don't have to memorize stages and then dodge like everything, and you don't get easily, you know, you don't get so many enemies on screen that you're just forced to be overwhelmed and then lose a quarter. I feel like this game's a lot more fair and a lot more playable than the original, if not a little less interesting overall. Gotcha. But certainly you want to play it to get to the last few stages and the last boss, because that's kind of a wild time. That, again, I won't spoil it for you because you can get there yourself. So go ahead and pick this game up and get there.
Sounds good. Chris, yep. It is always a pleasure having you on. It sounds like you had a nice batch of games, you know, Urban Champion.
I had fun with it, but, you know, I played the original when I was much younger, too, so I knew what I was getting into.
Yeah, so you had that going for you. But that is it for this episode. Thanks again for coming on and chatting about the games. Thanks to Purnell and Jacob as well. Hopefully Jacob's feeling a bit better by the time this episode launches.
Oh boy.
Music, we're going to go with some tunes from Sam Mulligan and the Donut Slayers.
All right.
Because I've been meaning to play them, but, you know, Tiberian Suns came up, so I played Tiberian Suns.
Oh, yeah, no, I understand. Got to get all those MAGFest acts out.
Goddamn right. And hopefully Sam Mulligan's MAGFest set will be available soon. I've been dying to watch that over.
Yeah, I miss MAGFest, so I need to see that, too. And it's cool to see my friend D-Mock on the bass, you know, playing with other folks.
Yeah, she tore it up.
Yeah, she's been doing really good with Seal Samurai, too.
Good stuff.
Love that Darmok.
Oh, man. But yeah, that is it for this episode. Chris, do you have any final words to take us home?
Fuck Urban Champion.
I got my ninja sword. I'm gonna be a samurai someday. You'll say he's so cool. Been practicing my slash. Yeah, you give me all of your cash, because I told you to. When the day finally arrives, then I can say I'm a samurai. I'll also say I told you so. Got my ninja sword. I'm gonna be a samurai someday. You'll say you killed my whole family. Well, boo-hoo. When the day finally arrives.
to all the enemy samurai warriors, I've got a little message for you. I'm gonna do what James Hetfield told me to do back in 82. Actually, it might have been 1984, but I don't know, and I don't care. I'm gonna kill them all. Don't start no shit, it won't be no shit, yeah.
place to.
Dozens and 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 d